Mahalia Jackson was invited to kick off the primetime segment of what came to be known as simply the March on Washington on Wednesday, August 28, 1963. Nothing else has ever quite measured up. The logistics of the day alone were daunting. Putting it all together, however, was a group of people that by no means reflected the harmonies of Jackson's song. Joining us to talk about the backstory of the March on Washington is Charles Eichner. Charlie is the author of Nobody Turned Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington, a chronicle of the heart and soul of what is considered the Great March on Washington in 1963. Charlie, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thank you for having me.
You know, right off the bat, even when it was maybe just a twinkle in some folks' eyes, President Kennedy wanted them to call off the march.
Yeah, well, President Kennedy in June had announced the most significant civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. And he feared that a mass of demonstrators on the Mall saying who knows what and doing who knows what would threaten his efforts to get the legislation passed on Capitol Hill. He also just believed in a much more mainstream kind of way of doing politics through the legislative process and through the courts. And so he pled with the march organizers, including A. Philip Randolph, whose dream it was to have a march going back to 1941.
Right.
He said, we can't have them on the streets. And Mr. Randolph said, Mr. President, they're already in the streets, and that took care of that.
And not to jump, you know, cut to the chase, but in the end, the president was pleased.
He was pleased. You know, when he realized that this was going to happen, he actually mobilized the administration to, on the one hand, help the march organizers, and the other hand, keep an eye on them and make sure that they didn't stray too far away from the mainstream of liberal civil rights activism. And so, you know, a lot of people were very critical of Kennedy, and certainly he deserved a lot of skepticism and criticism, and he needed to have his feet kept to the fire. But he also played a constructive role in making this thing come off in the final analysis.
Yeah, I was surprised to read, you know, in this kind of book that's filled with surprises, because there's not a lot of detail that's been done about the march in the past.
Right.
Is the fact that I can't remember if it was the Army Corps of Engineers, whoever helped him fix the sound system. The sound system had been sabotaged.
Yeah, it was sabotaged overnight. And to Bayard Rustin, who I think is one of the great unheralded heroes of not only civil rights but all kinds of activism in the 20th century, the peace movement, the anti-arms movement, the gay rights movement, the labor movement, civil rights, Bayard Rustin felt that having a strong sound system was absolutely essential, because if you have a big crowd and people can't hear what's going on, then they're going to kind of break off and they're going to get distracted, and that's when people who want to subvert the march, and there were a number of segregationists who wanted to kind of break in and start fights and so forth, that's when they'll get distracted and that's when things get out of control. So when this sound system was monkey wrenched the previous evening on Tuesday evening, the 27th, it was a real crisis. But Walter Fauntroy, who later went on to become elected as a delegate to Congress, he worked with the Army Corps of Engineers, and they got it fixed by the next morning, just in time for the festivities to begin.
I want to get back to more about Rustin, of course, but just in general, they talk about the Big Ten as the Big Ten organizing groups, the Big
Right.
Ten elements that put this thing together. Can you tell us about who they were and how that all came together?
Well, the march organizers started out as the Big Six, which was the major civil rights organizations at the time, which included the NAACP, the National Urban League, Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, and the Negro Labor Organization. But as soon as they decided to come together as the Big Six, they decided to expand it to the Big Ten, which included labor and religious organizations. These people, in a way that is so deep and so profound and so inspiring to my mind, they so believed in integration. They did not want this to be a black march. They didn't even really want it to be a march for black rights. They wanted it to be an integrated march for human rights. And although the primary focal point of that was getting blacks their due place in the system, they did not want this to be kind of one faction demanding something from the whole. They wanted it to be a broad group demanding basic rights for everybody in the system. And I think that was absolutely critical. And it was very much in danger at the time because there were a lot of young civil rights activists who were getting really impatient with both the idea of nonviolence and integration. And so and they also needed to present their face as an integrated group to the white community, to the majority of America. So this was absolutely critical when they expanded from the Big Six to the Big Ten.
My guest is Charles Eichner. He's the author of Nobody Turned Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. To our listeners, did you attend the March on Washington? Do you know someone who did? And if you didn't, do you remember it? Were you conscious at the time? Give us a call and tell us what your recollections are of that time. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You said it was difficult to pull all those different groups together. It did create – therein lay much of the conflict that ensued afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
With the religious organizations, there was a big hairy deal about one of the speeches.
Right.
I think it was with the cardinal from Washington, D.C.
That's right. John Lewis, who is now an esteemed member of Congress from Georgia, back then he was a very young leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which probably had the most, I don't know if this is a contradiction in terms, but the most radical mainstream approach to this. They very much wanted to be integrated into the American system, but they were really impatient. And John Lewis wrote a speech expressing that impatience in really fervent, powerful terms. And when the Archbishop of the Catholic Diocese in Washington found out about this the night before, he threatened to pull out of the march entirely, all the Catholics, all the priests and nuns. He was going to call them out. And he was ready to make an announcement. But there were a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiations and Bayard Rustin and Roy Wilkins and a whole variety of other of the more senior leaders of the movement talked to Lewis. He ended up revising it. I believe that his speech became much more powerful because of this for two reasons. First of all of Lewis's friends and allies knew about this going on, so they knew about the more what you might call incendiary first draft. But at the same time, when Lewis revised it, He actually didn't cut back many punches. It remained a very powerful plea to the nation as a whole and to the movement to hurry up, that time was running out for this great cause.
There were, on the other hand, a couple groups that weren't necessarily represented, at least not in any major way. And one of them, of course, was the women.
Right.
I enjoyed that you remarked on the adage, women organize while men lead.
Yeah. Well, I think that the March on Washington had a number of spin-off effects, and I don't think I'll ever be able to prove this, but I believe that the beginning of the free speech movement on college campuses, as well as a kind of ramping up of the women's movement, they both got a big boost from the March on Washington. As you said, the women, many women activists who worked so hard to make civil rights protests and campaigns possible throughout the country, north and south, east and west, they did not get the representation they deserved. They did not get their own speaker. They were introduced, and Daisy Bates said a few words on behalf of the women, but they did not get the spotlight that they clearly deserved. And they were upset, and they lobbied behind the scenes, and they ran into a narrow chauvinistic point of view, you know, among some of the great civil rights leaders, including Bayard Rustin, who I just idolized. But he didn't really get it, like most men didn't really get it at that time, that, you know, that you can't promote the interests of one group and ignore the interests of another. But I believe that the march, this behind-the-scenes debate and struggle that was taking place, really gave a lot of impetus to the women's movements going forward. Of course, there was a lot of other stuff going on. I don't want to overstate mm-hmm. it, but it was a boost. And then at the same time, the Lewis controversy that we talked about, really opened up the idea that, you know, you can't tell young people what they can and cannot say. And the free speech movement broke out in Berkeley the very next year. And so it's very important that when you have occasions like this, that it's not just the immediate message, but the kind of spin-off messages that oftentimes make a big impact.
Well, I mean, this was a long time coming, obviously, but the bigness of it, the amazing things about it are also, because of that, created those schisms.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this was any time you get so many groups under one tent, you know, there's bound to be tension. And I think that really the spirit of the day ended up being creative tension. And even though there were hard feelings here and there along the way, some people didn't get to speak. Some people didn't get the prominence. The placards were written ahead of time, and there was some conflict over that. Unemployed worker did not get to speak. The original plan called for an unemployed worker to take the podium. So there were a lot of things that were a little bit tense, and there were some hurt feelings along the way. But fundamentally, when you bring this massive group, massive people together, and when you speak with one voice about a message as powerful as this, it's going to make an impact. And that's why we're talking about it today, almost 50 years later.
Whitney Young, he was executive secretary of the National Urban League. He put forth, as you put it, a wide-ranging domestic program in his speech. Let's listen to an excerpt.
Great.
They must march from the rat-infested, overcrowded ghettos to decent, wholesome, unrestricted residential areas dispersed throughout our cities. They must march from the relief rolls to the established retraining centers, from underemployment as unskilled workers to higher occupations commensurate with our skills.
Now, I was surprised at the detail of his speech, bearing in mind that it was, as you put it, a broad agenda for anyone with black issues. But at first, the Urban League wasn't really interested in the march at all.
Right. Yeah, the Urban League and the NAACP both said no. And Martin Luther King also, by the way, they all said no at first. We've got other things to do, they said. We've got an agenda that we're kind of overwhelmed by already. But here's the thing I find most fascinating about when you create a big tent and you invite a lot of people to come to it, that even the so-called conservative characters, and Whitney Young was considered a conservative corporate type, even they bring surprising things to the table. Now, Whitney Young had managed to get himself into the inner circles of the Kennedy administration's poverty and urban agendas. And he was kind of behind the scenes writing the agendas, and he would continue to write them under President Johnson after Kennedy was assassinated. And so he was really sketching out the broad outlines of the Great Society in this speech and during this period. Now, there were a lot of black radicals and even just more liberal folks who weren't really appreciating Whitney Young because they thought he was too corporate, too conservative. But here he was, the guy sketching out the most ambitious agenda of all. So, you know, when you bring that diverse group of people together and when you give them a common focus, amazing things can happen. And I think Whitney Young is one of those underappreciated figures. I certainly didn't appreciate him as much before I got going on this project.
We're going to have to take a break. When we return, we'll get to those calls. I'm looking forward to that. We'll hear a lot more audio from the March on Washington in 1963, and we'll continue our conversation with Charles Eichner. He's the author of Nobody Turned Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Karen Armstrong's lifelong research into religion led her to consider the deepest questions of human beings.
What is the nature of happiness? What is the meaning of our mortality?
Now she's created a new prescription for living with compassion and empathy. I'm Neil Conan. Karen Armstrong joins us on her new book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4, right here on 89.7 NPR News. It's 20 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Cloudy skies today, a high of 34 degrees. There's a chance of rain tonight, possibly a little freezing rain, and a low right around 33. Rain showers are likely off and on throughout the day on Tuesday and a high of 40 degrees. And then a wintry mix for Tuesday night. Rain possibly mixing with some snow overnight and a low of 26 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the book, Nobody Turned Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. It's a new book by author Charles Eichner. If you have a story to tell about the March on Washington in 1963, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Don, you're from the east side of Columbus, and you remember something about that.
Yes, I was a young teenager attending West High School in 1963. My parents didn't let me go to the march because they were afraid of trouble. Very conservative black parents, but I did travel out to the Woodland Y on Woodland Avenue right off of Long Street, where the buses picked up, oh, it must have been six or eight buses that picked up people that were going to the march, but it was certainly an exciting time during that. And when the Million Man March came around, I made sure I went and took my two sons with me so they could experience that kind of crowd and what it meant. But we watched it on black and white TV in town, and it was an exciting time.
Charlie, the whole bus culture and those kinds of events as they embarked on the journey, those were big events in themselves locally.
Yeah, they really were. And I love this comment, and thank you so much for calling. Because, you know, these marchers went there with such a sense of excitement, and a lot of them were sent off by people like you who couldn't go for one reason or another. But they really kind of took your message with them. And one of the reasons they had so much energy and so much excitement and so much soul, if you will, is that they felt themselves kind of the ambassadors for all of America. And so I'm not engaging in any hyperbole when I say they were thinking of you when they were out on the mall. So you were there yourself in a way.
I'm sure of that.
Don, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Let's hear. I found an interesting audio cut. They did arrive by busload. That was the common way to get there. And they were well prepared. In this audio recording, we hear the organizer in charge of one busload of marchers, including some UAW members.
Do you have any questions?
Wake up, girl.
Or anything that's bothering you? Be sure you contact your captains for anything, and they will take it from there. Do not try to do anything on your own, because the minute you do, you will be upsetting the purpose of this march. The whole thing is an orderly, conducted march.
These bus organizers, they had their scripts. They had very specific things they wanted to tell their riders. And it was an interesting culture. Some people wanted to get on the cool buses. What was going on with all that?
Yeah, well, the buses, as you say, were critically important, not only for moving all those bodies from far away into Washington, but also that it gave them a chance to essentially have a kind of rolling pep rally along the way, but also to get schooled in the strategies of nonviolence, because they did not know, as your previous caller pointed out, they did not know if there wouldn't be violence, and they had to be prepared for it. And in fact, Bayard Rustin, the great organizer of this thing, he recruited a couple thousand retired police in New York to serve as security officials, and he taught them the strategies of nonviolent crowd control. And in fact, he had to get a special dispensation from the New York Police Department to get them to not bring any weapons, because if you use weapons in nonviolent conflict, it isn't nonviolent anymore. So these buses, they were rolling concerts and rolling pep rallies and rolling debates and rolling seminars on nonviolence. It was really an extraordinary thing in and of itself. And when they were rolling along down these highways and they saw other buses, and they saw these streams of buses come together, it created this amazing excitement that we are all in this together. And I think that was as big a part of the march as anything that happened on the mall that day.
Some of them had to travel through the interstate highway system hadn't been built yet, and it was in its infancy. Some of them had to travel through towns that probably didn't welcome them.
Yeah, they did. There was some of that, and some of them were pelted with rocks and things like that along the way. But also, they were welcomed by many people. There's a wonderful documentary about the march by Haskell Wexler called The Bus, and it's hard to get, but it's worth finding if you can. And that one really touching scene I remember from that, this was a group of people coming from San Francisco, and one touching scene is when the bus stopped in Amana, Iowa, and all these people who had probably not been far from Amana, Iowa their whole life kind of welcomed these marchers with open arms, and they talked about farming, and they talked about where they came from and where the marchers were doing and what they hoped to achieve. So, you know, yeah, there were some rough moments on some of the routes, but there was also this sense of kind of open arms in other places as well.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the March on Washington in 1963. If you'd like to join the conversation with your own story of that day and those times, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Abdul from Columbus, you have a story about another march going on someplace far away.
Yes, actually, I was in Somalia, and I was 7 years old and second grade. And I remember we came out that day with all Somali students all over the country. Schools were shut down, came out, and actually we were crying far more than anybody else was thinking about it. But anyway, and that was a great time and great participation. But the other thing is, I think it's not enough to speak about civil rights and the achievements we made with Dr. King without mentioning and celebrating it with Malcolm X, and also without thanking the Jewish community, without saying them thank you for their participation. I think you cannot take only one person for the civil rights, but to put it in perspective, Malcolm X was also the same or equal to Dr. King, but the other side wanted to eliminate him because I don't know the reason. I've been enough in America, and I understand it. That's why you cannot talk Dr. King without putting him right on the spot. You cannot separate Jefferson from Washington or Adams or Benjamin. You have to take perspective. You cannot deny the history on deliberately African-Americans cannot. If somebody else, they don't want to hear it, I don't think we should eliminate it. And that's my point. Thank you.
Thanks, Abdul, for your call. Indeed, Charlie, that was a lot of the point of your book, was that it was many minds, many people.
Absolutely. And you know, it's a funny thing about Malcolm X, too, because he spent the whole summer really deriding in the most scorching terms the civil rights movement and the mainstream civil rights movement and its allies. And he had what he called the Harlem Unity Rally in New York City just a couple weeks before the march. And you cannot hear more pointed invective than you heard that day. And it was oftentimes quite anti-Semitic and just totally anti-white. So there was that dimension of Malcolm X. But on the other hand, he showed up at the march, even though he was officially boycotting it. And behind the scenes, he offered his help to the march organizers. Malcolm X was a very complex man, and he was still in the process of maturing and developing a really kind of big vision for Black America and Blacks around the world. And so he was trying to figure this out, and he went to Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis, who was the MC of the march the night before, and he said, if there's anything I can do, help me. Another march speaker, Floyd McKissick, who was there to speak for James Farmer, who was in jail at the time, McKissick hugged Malcolm when he saw him in the Statler Hilton, and McKissick's younger associate said, why in the world are you hugging him? He's been speaking so bitterly against civil rights and against the march. And McKissick said, you know what? That guy saved my life. My house was surrounded by Klansmen, and he sent his people there to rescue me. So, you know, all these relationships, even when the rhetoric was so heated and so extreme, all these people found a way to contribute to the movement. And that's another thing that was so beautiful about this day, which, by the way, was the only time that all of the factions of the movement came together on one day. And that's, I believe, why it was so important for this day to happen in 63.
it was complicated. There were lots of stuff going on. One of the, I guess, you know, you mentioned Phil Randolph. He was the leader of the march.
Right.
A. Philip Randolph, at the time, I think he was president of the Sleeping Car Porters Union. He was the founder of the Black Labor Movement in the United States.
Negro American Labor Council.
Right.
An organization he founded, yeah.
Let's hear from him at the march.
This civil rights revolution is not confined to the Negro, nor is it confined to civil rights. For our white allies know that they cannot be free, while we are not.
Now, he was really a big reason why Bayard Rustin wasn't left behind in this process.
Yeah. Yeah. Bayard Rustin was a protege of Philip Randolph going back about 20 years. And Bayard Rustin was the man to organize this thing. He was a better organizer than anybody. He knew how to coordinate big events. They had actually done a few kind of trial runs on the mall in 57, 58, and 59. March for Integrated Schools and a couple other marches. And he understood strategy, he understood tactics, he understood organizing. But a lot of the other march organizers did not want him to run it because he had a controversial background. First of all, he was gay, which was considered highly controversial in those days.
And he was openly gay.
And he was openly mm-hmm. gay, that's right. And he also had refused service in World War II because he was a pacifist to the bone. And he also had done a number of controversial things over the years, and including he had been a member of the Communist Party really mm-hmm. briefly before World War II. And so he was considered to be kind of radioactive by a lot of people, and they didn't want him to run the march. But Randolph said, you know what? I'll take over the march. I'll run it. And so everybody heaved a sigh of relief and say, okay, good, Mr. Randolph's going to run it. And then he immediately said, okay, Bayard's going to be my deputy, and he's going to do all the work.
So, the sign of a great leader, a delegate.
You have to maneuver. You have to have great timing, you know, the timing of a musician or of an artist or of a dancer. And Randolph certainly had that. And this march could not have happened without Bayard Rustin.
614-292-8513 if you want to tell us a story about the day of the march. I thought that was interesting that Abdul brought up the fact that they marched in Somalia. I think it was the day before the march,
right.
W.E.B. Du Bois died, and he was out of the country as well. He was in Ghana.
Right, he was in Ghana.
And they were marching in Ghana.
Right. Yeah, they were marching all over the country. There were a number of expats in Paris who marched.
Mm-hmm.
There were people in London who marched. All over the world, people were marching. And it was really an extraordinary thing because, you know, the influence of the American Civil Rights Movement was profound even back then. There was a great interview on public radio immediately after the march, in the hours after the march, and they were talking to a guy from South Africa who said, you know what? This gives us hope that apartheid is going to fall. And when you have a spectacle like this with so much nobility and so much heroism and so much unselfishness, really focused on an ideal goal of true brotherhood and equality of opportunity, and dedicated to principles of nonviolence, and dedicated to, you know, Mr. Randolph, when he spoke those words that white men cannot be free until black men are free, they really meant that. They really understood that whites were just as burdened by racism as blacks were. It was a different kind of burden, obviously. They mm-hmm. didn't suffer materially or physically the way that blacks did, and I don't mean to equate them. But there's no way that whites could truly become as good as they could become in a racist system. And when people like Mr. Randolph expressed that and people like Martin Luther King expressed that and Roy Wilkins, they meant it. They felt that from the heart, and you could feel it when they spoke. And the people in the crowd, you know, I've got a lot of images, video images as well as stills of people in the crowd reacting to these speakers, and it was visceral, the connection these speakers made with the crowd. And I believe it was so visceral because they believed it deep in their hearts. And that's why the connection overseas was as powerful, too, because people saw, you know what, if you can defeat apartheid in America, you can defeat it in South Africa. And people really started to believe that when they saw the civil rights movement unfolding in the U.S.
There was so much history up on the stage that day. Mm. Marian Anderson was considered the premier female concert vocalist of her day.
Yep.
But here she sings a very simple song, "He's Got the Whole World in His Hands."
He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the big round world in his hands. He's got the wide world in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the wind and the rain in his hands. He's got the moon and the stars.
She was considered Pastor Prime at the time, like I mentioned, but she had already made history in 1939.
That's right. In 1939, of course, she gave the great concert at the National Mall. And it was really the mall's baptism as a place of great human congregation. She was the greatest contralto of her time, most people believed. And they tried to arrange a concert for her at the Constitution Hall, but the Daughters of the American Revolution said no because she was black. They tried to arrange another concert at a public school. They said no because she was black. And so a number of people, including First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, came up with the idea of having her hold a concert on the Mall on Easter Sunday in 1939. And so she did, and she sung a number of songs, but one of them, most poignantly, was "My Country, 'Tis of Thee." And that really, in its own way, did as much to make this March on Washington possible as anything else. I mean, that's the thing about great events like this, is that they are rivers fed by many streams. And the greatness of this day, August 28th, 1963, owed itself not only to all those many thousands of people who congregated and the work they did back home, New York, Mississippi, Alabama, wherever, but also the great events that preceded it, including something we haven't talked about yet, but in 1941, A. Philip Randolph had organized another march on Washington that only got called off because Franklin Roosevelt met his demands for an executive order banning discrimination in wartime industries. So there were lots of events feeding into this, and Marian Anderson's brilliant concert back in 39 was certainly one of the greatest moments in this great public place.
Of course, you know, one of the things about your book that makes it so enjoyable to read is you kick the whole thing off with a story about two teenage boys from the South hiking and hitchhiking and walking. I mean,
it's unbelievable. Three teenage boys, actually.
Three, okay.
From Gadsden, Alabama, about a week and a half before the march. They had been active in the movement all year. They were 15, 16, and 17 years old, and they met at one of their favorite meeting places where organizers did their work in Gadsden, Alabama. And they said, you know, I really want to go to the march, but they didn't have money. They couldn't buy a bus ticket, and so they decided to hitchhike. And so they hitchhiked all the way to Washington. And when they got there, they met all the great leaders of the movement, including Bayard Rustin, and they got put to work making the signs that people carried on the day of the march. They got put up in a beauty school dormitory, and they had the time of their lives, and then they helped to make history. But what's especially poignant to me about their story is that when they first started their march, their longest march to Washington, they walked past this space just north of Gadsden, Alabama, where a white postman named William Moore had been shot down. William Moore was walking from Chattanooga, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi to deliver a plea to the governor of Mississippi, Ross Barnett, to elevate who you are and embrace civil rights. He, of course, was one of the most vociferous segregationists. And when Moore got shot dead just outside Gadsden, it really galvanized the Galveston civil rights movement, which had not really taken hold yet. And it got these three boys involved. And when they marched or when they walked past the spot where William Moore was killed, they got on their knees and they prayed. And one of them told me later that's when he really knew they were going to the march, because they because it was part of something bigger than them. It wasn't just the excitement of youth. It was also something much bigger. And off they went.
We're going to have to take another break. My guest is Charles Eichner. He's author of Nobody Turned Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear the questions you wish you could have asked to people like Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Did it help to hear what your voice sounded like on helium? Did you learn something about your voice you didn't know before?
Yeah, I learned that I don't really need the helium.
Because it's pretty easy to flick that switch and go right up there.
The most interesting people in show business on Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins this afternoon, starting at noon. On today's edition of the program, Martin Luther King's most famous speech was the I Have a Dream speech. On the next Fresh Air, a discussion with Clarence Jones, who helped draft the speech, but he says it was almost entirely spontaneous. Jones says he was not speaking from written context, except for the first 9 paragraphs. Join us for that discussion on Fresh Air today at noon, here on 89.7 NPR News. And in just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour 2 of All Sides begins, and we'll hear about the importance of mass mobilization and mass action to the achievements of the civil rights movement. And we'll also hear about the struggle for racial equality as it continues today. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher beginning at 11 o'clock. 20 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today and a high of 34 degrees. A chance of rain tonight, maybe a little freezing rain and a low of 33. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Charles Eichner. He's the author of Nobody Turned Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. The memory of that day or of that time, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's hear from Walter Reuther, who's the president of the UAW. He spoke without a written script before him.
If we can have full employment and full production for the negative ends of war, then why can't we have a job for every American in the pursuit of peace?
You know, as you mentioned, Charlie, jobs and the economics of poverty really became the cornerstone of the March on Washington. It wasn't just about race. But Walter Reuther was also a plant from the Kennedy administration.
Well, he was and he wasn't. I mean, okay. The Kennedy administration wanted someone like him there. But he had been really involved in civil rights for many years. He was very close to Martin Luther King personally. And, he was kind of struggling within the union movement mm-hmm. himself. He was very much at odds with George Meany, who was the head of the AFL-CIO. And Meany refused to endorse the march, and he did not go. But Reuther said, no, this is our cause, too. You can't be pro-worker and not be pro-civil rights. And he went very proudly and very actively, and the UAW paid for a lot of the expenses of the march, including they paid for all the placards, all the signs that people carried. So he was really dedicated to civil rights. He struggled a little bit within the labor movement itself. The labor movement had very strong pockets of racism, very strong resistance to civil rights. And so he was a man who, in his own way, was in the middle of the struggle. But you're right, he was also close to Kennedy, and Kennedy wanted him to keep an eye on things and make sure that the more radical elements of the movement didn't get out of control, at least in their minds.
Did he really have much a hand in that in the end?
Well, yeah, I think Reuther played a very powerful role. For example, during the John Lewis controversy over mm-hmm. the speech, Reuther was the guy who was in minute-by-minute contact with the Catholic archbishop, who was threatening to withdraw from the march. And he tried to put pressure on Lewis to tone down his rhetoric or at least change his rhetoric. I don't think it was actually toned down much. I think it was just chained, and I think it was made more powerful, actually, in the next version. But Reuther was right in the middle of the day-to-day, hour-by-hour kind of maneuvering to just make sure that things moved forward. And he cut big checks when big checks need to be cut, And he also worked closely with King and all the other organizers as well.
You know, getting back to that John Lewis speech, it struck me just because of that movie, The King speech, that's out right now and very popular movie. But John Lewis had a speech impediment as well, which was one of the reasons why one person speculated he might have been worried about changing it at the last minute.
Yeah, Rochelle Horowitz, a very interesting character, wonderful woman. I talked at length to her about her role. She's the one who organized all the buses, all the transportation for the march. But she lived in an apartment in the Lower East Side of New York. And just about a week before the march, John Lewis came by the march headquarters and asked if the people there would look at his speech, and they spiffed it up a little bit. And then he would practice it at her apartment. She was living there with a couple other women. And actually, one of the other guests to their apartment on occasion was Bob Dylan. And so she remembers going to sleep one night listening to John Lewis practice his speech. And he had just gotten it down. This is what Rochelle says. He had really just gotten it down. He struggled, as you say, with a speech impediment. And the idea of changing it all at the last minute was unsettling to him. So that's at least one theory about why he was so distressed about the speech being changed at the last minute.
Well, speaking of Bob Dylan, I have a cut from a song he sang. Now, this is not from the march, but it's a song he sang at the march. He's only a pawn in their gang. He sings about the poor white man who is manipulated by the white power structure, the police, the courts, the politicians, to perpetrate racist hate.
Mm-hmm. But the poor white man's used in the hands of them all like a tool. He's taught in his school from the start by the rule that the laws are with him to protect his white skin, to keep up his hate, so he never thinks straight about the shape that he's in. So it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in that game.
How was the reaction to performers, entertainers like John Dylan, Joan Baez, and others showing up for the march and for the program?
Well, it was,
the program.
It was mostly great excitement because, it turned it into a really diverse, I don't want to say festival because that is, it sounds like it's trivializing it, but a really diverse congregation of all of America. And having someone like Bob Dylan, who really represented a kind of rising wave of youth activism, was terrific. Then the thing that's really so important about Dylan, though, is, you know, you played a clip from Only a Pawn in Their Game. This was a song about the murder of Medgar Evers earlier that summer on June 12th. And Medgar Evers was this beloved state director for the NAACP in Mississippi. And he was, by all accounts, the gentlest, most decent, most hardworking and committed man. And he was gunned down in his driveway coming home from work at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And what Dylan was trying to express here is that racism is a complex thing. It's not just ignorant people thinking stupid things, although it's certainly that. It's also insecure people being manipulated by others who have their own power agendas. And it's important for this message to be heard because you can't turn something as profound as civil rights into a kind of cartoon, a very simplistic kind of issue of either you're good or you're bad. There were a lot of pressures that a lot of people were under, and I think Dylan really understood that. And this song is just a beautiful kind of account, a crying out that we have to understand the roots of white racism if we're going to ever deal with them.
And he was well received.
He was very well received. I mean, there were some people there who were a little disappointed that there weren't more black musical performers. You know, there was Bob Dylan, who was white, and Joan Baez, who was white, and Peter Paul and Mary, who were white.
Mm-hmm.
And this one guy, John Handy, who was a really brilliant jazz musician and who really played on some of the all-time great jazz pieces. Handy was there, and he was upset that there was no representation of jazz, which is one of the all-time great contributions of America to world culture. But, you know, for the most part, people were really happy that the gathering included everybody from everywhere and all perspectives. Anybody who cared about justice and cared about civil rights and equal opportunity, they were there. And I think everybody was really welcomed as part of that group.
Now, I do want to get to Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, but I also want to mention there were horrible death threats that people, the organizers, faced throughout this process.
Yeah.
Horrible stuff.
Yeah, well, there were bomb threats all the time, and there were death threats, and the FBI was sometimes attentive, and it sometimes was not attentive. But, you know, things could have turned out very badly. There was one really poignant story, which I've never read anywhere before, but one of Martin Luther King's old friends from seminary was up on the platform with King. He was only about 15 or 20 feet away. And when King was finished his speech, he was surrounded by security people and kind of hustled off to meet the other march leaders. They were on their way to the White House at that point. And King's old friend said that he saw a look of fear in King's eyes, because King always expected that at a big occasion he might be assassinated. And this man told me that King, whenever there was a big occasion, King wrote a speech, or didn't necessarily write it. Sometimes they were just kind of pastiches of different pieces he had done before. But he always tried to make speeches in big moments be good enough for a last speech, because he thought he could be killed at any time. And, of course, the mountaintop speech, which came right before he was assassinated in Memphis in 1968, kind of fits this character. But this guy said that King really considered the possibility that this could have been his last speech. Security was always an issue.
Well, let's hear from a lesser-known part of the speech, the famous dream speech by Martin Luther King Jr. It's often remembered by the refrain, "I have a dream," but there was more to it by far. Here he talks about the checks and balances of power in a society in terms of a bad check representing bad faith, failed promises, and broken contracts.
We refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. And so we've come to cash this check,
yes!
A check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom,
yes,
and the security of justice.
Yes, yes!
Now, Charlie, I guess some folks will say that this speech was almost entirely spontaneous, but as you mentioned earlier, many of his speeches were pastiches of other phrases and thoughts from other speeches,
right.
but also you paint a picture of a pretty a cadre of his aides working together to refine the speech.
Oh, they
in
worked
the end.
Really hard on this. That particular passage came the previous week. They were all staying at the home of Clarence Jones, King's lawyer in New York City, and a number of them worked on this speech. King gave about 350 speeches that year, about one a day. So he clearly could not write a speech ahead of time for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a preacher. Preachers are used to kind of putting together bits and pieces and turning it into a quilt of oration. But this one they did work on long and hard. And there's a little bit of confusion. Some people think that the "I have a dream" line was totally spontaneous. But he had delivered it many times before, and he had debated it with his aides the night before. And someone who was sleeping in the very next hotel room tells me that he heard King practice the "I have a dream" line. And so I believe that King went to the mall intending on delivering that remark and just wanted to kind of keep it a little bit of a surprise and wanted to get a feel for the moment before launching with it finally.
Obviously, they probably wanted to rally the troops, but what were the finer points on their aim in terms of the speech?
Well, I think the critical thing was that King had to hold the center together. He had to keep the more liberal and anxious and impatient young people, mostly, not all young, but he had to keep the more radical elements of the movement in the center of the movement, meaning dedicated to both nonviolence and integration, which many were questioning at the time. And then he also had to appeal to white liberals who had been friends of the movement but had not done as much and had not been as wholeheartedly committed as they should have been. And then he also had to outflank the forces of segregation and out-and-out racism. And to me, the critical moment of the speech is not the four words, I have a dream, but a different four words, which is unearned suffering is redemptive. And that's where King tells his people that you do have to suffer to bring change. And I'm not going to gloss over that fact. This is hard, hard work, and we need to suffer along the way. But if you do suffer, if you're willing to make that mature commitment, that humane commitment, there will be something better on the other end. And I think this section of the speech is the soul of the whole day, and it's the soul of the whole movement. It's a mature leader talking to his people with the kind of honesty you almost never see in politics. He was not offering any easy answers. In fact, he was telling them that an incredible amount of hard work lay ahead, and even violence, but they had to continue because there was redeeming values that went far beyond any of the sacrifices that they would make.
All three networks carried the 7-minute speech. Yep. That was unprecedented.
Well, yeah, and CBS covered the whole event live, which mm-hmm. was also unprecedented. And Roger Mudd was the anchor of that mm-hmm. coverage. He had never anchored something like this before. He told me that he was so nervous, he went over to a shrub and threw up in it. He was just so anxious about what might happen that day, violence and subversion and all kinds of other stuff. But yeah, this, and it was not only televised live on national TV by all the speech by all three networks, the day by CBS, but it was also televised by satellite globally. And this kind of tied in with some of those demonstrations across the world that you were talking about before. This was the first, global mm-hmm. populist movement in a way. Certainly Gandhi's movement in India for independence attracted international attention. But mm-hmm. here was the first time that the whole world was watching as it was unfolding.
Well, Charlie Eichner, thank you for sharing your perspective today.
And thank you so much for having me.
Charlie Eichner, he's the author of Nobody Turn Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.